This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world. Today, an old friend is back with us. He's become an old friend, Paul Sinclair. I discovered Paul a few years ago. He sent me a book about strange goings-on in Yorkshire and his life as a researcher. And now he's opened up Pandora's box. Paul, welcome to Dreamland.
Whitley, thank you very much. It's wonderful to be talking to you again. And as you know, I'm always delighted to speak with you because you were one of the first people to really give me some time to share my experiences, to share the sightings. And yeah, thank you. Great right. to be here.
Well, you and gosh, William Henry, Peter Lavenda. Yeah, I look for people who have something to offer who nobody is listening to. And I've gotten fairly good at that over the years. And I think I have anyway. And I have to tell you that your new book, Night People, is a stunner. But before we start, there's something very interesting going on. At the beginning of the book, Paul speaks, and he'll tell you about this in just a minute, of an eerie silence. Well, an eerie silence fell over this place, this apartment, just before I started to do the show. I thought, how can it be this quiet? And it is very, very quiet. It's a little bit more noise now than it was, but for a few minutes there, it was absolutely silent. And on that note, Paul, why don't you start by telling us a little bit about the experience in 1970 walking home with your parents?
Yeah, it was New Year's Eve, 1970. And obviously, I was just a little boy, but we've managed to piece a timeline of events up for the book. So it goes through childhood to present day, just about, you know, only probably 3 or 4 months ago. But New Year's Eve 1970, my mum and dad were members of a social club here in the UK, like a sports club where they'd go and, you know, drink alcohol and have a nice time with other families, other couples, and children were allowed. And at Christmas times, there'd be two parties, and probably one in the summer for some other event or sporting event. And this particular time, it was very icy, thick with snow. My dad obviously were going to have more than he should have for driving. So we walked the 3 to 4 mile journey to a place called Swinton. We lived in a little village called Old Denneby. We walked there. We were all in high spirits. It were wonderful. And, you know, all the adults were happy. It was a wonderful time, children playing. It was just great. And then on the way home, and bearing in mind, people, I'm not sure any child at that age would have been keeping a diary of events, so I don't know the exact time we were setting off home, but it was well after midnight, so we're into the new year. And that's what I've got, Whitley. I have a really good memory for things. So I can hear the crunching of the ice under feet and the absolute silence, and not the eerie silence that you've just referred to, just the silence of the New Year's morning, and it was just wonderful. So I'm walking with my mum and dad down Church Street, and we take a right onto what's called Ferryboat Lane. These locations, people, even though we're in, most of your listeners might be in a different country, you can Google Earth these places, and onto the bridge that goes over the canal. And then on to the Iron Bridge that goes over the River Don. Now, the Iron Bridge held a little bit of a special place in my heart because when you ran along it, it clanged. The steel plates on the floor and the wrought iron railings, and you could hear the river crashing below over the rocks and things. And as we're approaching the Don, I can hear all this, and it's fabulous. And as I say, we're just in high spirits. It's been a wonderful night. We approached the railway crossing that would then lead us down to our home in Old Denneby. We were probably about 20 minutes away at that point. And you can see the street lights, and you can even pick our home out because it were only a little village. And to the right-hand side, there was a pond called the YEB Pond, the Yorkshire Electricity Board Pond. And to the left, there was marshland and swamps, you know, bulrushes growing, or reeds, should we say. It's white over, so the conditions are absolutely brilliant. And I'm sort of walking down, we're walking down from the railway line, and I think my dad must have seen them first, but there was two rabbits, a black and white one and a white one and a brown guinea pig. I apologise, listeners, where this is leading, but it's a bizarre story, and they just sat there. And these are domestic animals in a wild environment, which is not normal. It's just not normal. So anyway, I immediately cast eyes on these, and I want them. Little boy, I've got a rabbit at home and a large rabbit cage. Suddenly they're going to become my pets. And that's what I want. So I don't pull away from my mum. I think I were holding her hand or whatever. And I'm saying, can I have them? And I don't know what I'm saying. I can't remember all them years ago. But my mum says, can you see them, Bob? My dad were called Robert, so his nickname was Bob. And he went, yeah, I can see them. I can see them, Syl. My mum was Sylvia. He said, just keep walking. Keep walking. And I can't believe it. I'm looking at these animals. I want them. And I'm sort of pestering. He's a little boy sort of dancing about. And then the silence came. And I do remember the silence because I could... So it's nice that you mentioned that at the beginning as we approach this talk, Whitley, because everything went silent. It was quiet, and I tried to make, like, offer up analogies for this silence that didn't just affect me. I think it affects everybody that's been touched by this exotic science, this magic that we're all immersed in at some point in our lives, you know. And I imagine if you were in a vessel under the sea and you got the air and you pumped all the water out and you were left in this not dry room, but this sort of vacuum, this air-filled room under the ocean, it would feel that surreal.
Yeah, well, that's how it felt just before the show. We started working on the show.
Yeah, well, you said that, and I thought, yeah, well...
It's brilliant. So eerie, and it's still extremely quiet. Just a minute. Just hold on.
Okay.
Paul...
Yeah.
It is absolutely silent here. Absolutely silent. I'm in an apartment in a city in the middle of the morning, and there's nothing. There's not a single sound coming from anywhere.
That's
except
wonderful.
You. Yeah.
The spell
it's
of
very
sound.
Unusual. Let me put it that way. We don't have this. We do not have this.
Just had a few moments there then where we could just sip the silence and just, yeah, see, that's interesting in itself, Whitley. So
yeah, it's like somebody else is well aware of your presence on here. That's how it feels.
Now. To be honest, I've done a few shows this week and they've not got off the ground. One yesterday that they had massive technical problems, and they've apologized to me this morning and said they'd not experienced that before. I'm not one of these conspiracy theorists.
Oh, yeah. Listen, my listeners know all about that kind of technical problem. We have them all the time. But right now, things are very smooth here.
Well, that's cool. Let me not tempt fate then. So so I carry on. So
yeah, go ahead.
I by this time, I'm excited. I haven't realized there's a problem. And my dad, he was a hard man. I don't mean hard as in a fighting man or anything like that. He wouldn't run away from trouble, but he was very nothing frightened him. He was that kind of guy, and he was talking through gritted teeth and saying, "Just keep walking. Yeah, I've seen him," and I think he was swearing as well. And I couldn't understand that bit because I were focused on these animals. And in the end, I recall my mum holding my hand tight and just dragging me away. And that's when I saw them. I looked back as these animals are not disappearing into distance. Obviously, we're not running, but as we're leaving them, and stood in the field on the left-hand side, the marshland, and it's all white and frozen, are two beings. And that's all I can describe them as, Whitley. They were very tall. I don't want to say black, but they were dark coloured. I should imagine they would have been a dark grey colour. They'd got extra large heads. They'd got no clothing on, and they were stood basically. They looked like plasticine figures stood in the field, but they weren't.
How could you tell they weren't dressed?
There was nothing on them. If they were dressed, Whitley, they'd got skin-fitting suits on, let's put it that way. They were just smooth. You could see everything in the.
Did they have sexual parts?
No genitalia. There was nothing to discern. Any, should we say, rude parts to these beings? I described them before, apart from the heads being larger, as looking like Morph, the plasticine man.
You know,
I don't know if any of your listeners would be familiar with that, but in the UK there was a cartoon called Morph here, and it literally just looked like that. No. Don't forget, I only got a fleeting glimpse of these as my mum's dragging me away. But it were obvious that's what my dad had seen straight away, and my mum had seen them, you know, because she said, "Can you see them, Bob?" So off we go. We go home. I think I spoke about them a few times, and my dad said, you know, it'd just be a bad dream and forget about it. And right. They didn't really talk about it. Now, there was a bit of corroboration to this, and I'm going to find the guy. I don't know whether he saw the beings, but we had a neighbour next door but one. I'll not say her name. Unbelievably, she's over 100 now, but she's still alive. And I found that out only a few months ago.
So she's waiting for you? That happens.
Well, I'm definitely going to contact this lady. It's her son I need to contact. And I'll not say his surname, but his first name was Hugh. Now, I can remember her speaking to my mum, Ethel. Oh, good God. I'm sorry, guys. I've even said it. I'm tripping myself up here. This lady, I can remember speaking to my mum. And not that it's any great crime anyway, because it's the truth. And saying that Hugh had an unusual experience walking home. And he'd seen the two rabbits and the guinea pig. Now, I don't know how much deeper that went. I weren't privy to these conversations. I was just eavesdropping. And bearing in mind, Whitley, at that time, I were a little boy. I really didn't know what was happening. I didn't know the true extent of what was unfolding in my life and how it would pan out throughout the years. But so that's the story of the 1970s, and titled in the book the day night came to stay, because it were pretty dark after that, you know, as in the happenings and the events.
Well, yeah, and you're still in it. I mean, the night did come to stay. But let's now go back to the first events you personally remember, back to 1966.
1960, well, the first one I remember, yeah, the 1960s, and I believe that some of your listeners might remember this because I talked about it.
Tell us again. Yeah. I'm trying to set the stage here. So go ahead.
We lived in the little village at Old Denneby, as we've said, and my bedroom window looked over onto that very marshland where I saw these two beings. And in the distance, you'd got the town of Mexborough, which we'd walked through coming home on that Christmas. But this is before. And this particular night, I'd gone to bed, as I say, a pretty regimented my dad, ex-military. And when I went to bed, I couldn't get up. That was end of it. But he woke me up, which is unusual. And he wanted to show me an object to the right-hand side of my bedroom window over in the distance was the power station, the Mexborough power station. And lower than the cooling towers, but above the roofs of the town, and you could see all the street lights of the town, if I can just set the scene here, guys, and the houses running the full length until they got into the distance where Swinton would have been, there's a huge sphere of light. You know, if you imagine looking a mile away or three quarters of a mile away and seeing a house roof, well, this thing was bigger than a house roof, and it was a pale white sparkling colour, and it was turning, and it was slowly moving from the power station along the top of the rooftops. Obviously above the roofs, and I looked through them with the binoculars. My dad had some ex-naval binoculars, and I looked through them with them. He let me have a look, and it looked a lemony colour through the binoculars. Now, he said it was a weather balloon. Bearing in mind, my dad had no massive interest in UFOs or anything, and I think the common explanation for anything unexplained in the 1960s was a weather balloon. I mean, it's strange now that when these spheres of light are seen, Whitley, nobody's saying weather balloon anymore. You know, but there you go. So we watched this, and unusually, because it took ages and it were moving in a straight line above the rooftops, quite uncharacteristic to how a weather balloon would have moved, I would have thought. There were no wind, as I recall. He left me watching it, and that were unusual in itself. And I watched it, and it slowly travelled and disappeared. I can remember sort of straining my neck and looking, and it went towards Swinton. And so that was the first sighting or the first recall of anything unusual, should we say. And even then, as a small child, I didn't think to myself, oh, I've seen a UFO. I'd just seen something unusual. And it was one at rare occasions that I'd shared that experience with my dad, because, as I say, he were a strange kind of guy, as in he were always working, and when he weren't working, he did his own thing. He went fishing, he went shooting, and he didn't include me in lots of things, but that's the one that you're referring to, Whitley.
Yeah, exactly. So I always like to ask this, and I know my listeners, they ask it of me. They ask it of themselves, a lot of them. Why you?
Why me? Yeah, a good reason. And I don't think I'm special. I mean, I recall you asking me if I'd got a rare blood group, and I still haven't looked. Yeah. I don't think I have. But I also recall you asking me if I'd got any connections to Roslyn Chapel. And right. unusually,
it was a surprising question, wasn't it?
It really was. I mean, it weren't something we'd spoke about. It weren't something that'd be primed. And Whitley's going to ask me this. You asked. And I got a good friend who does family trees to have a look for me. And it turned out that not only have I got connections to Roslyn Chapel, when you look at a family tree and you see the branches jump all over the place, right, left, and in different combinations, there's a direct 17th generation linked to William St. Clair of Roslyn. So he's my 17th generation grandfather. Now, quite what that means, I don't know, but thanks to you.
It might mean an awful lot.
Yeah.
Because the Templars were part of this in a way that has been lost. It's secret now. It was secret then, for that matter. And they were rooted out by a dark force that I like to call a dark evil muscle that seeks to rule this world. And so now somebody's watching you. Who do you suppose they are?
Well, you know, all of these could be reasons, like, because you've just said, why me? In the first book I wrote about what I called the intermind connection. And I realize I'm talking about things, Whitley, that you will have probably looked into before. But, you know, when a person sees a UFO, perfect example, pilot sees UFO and locks his radar on, and suddenly, for no reason that human beings can understand, the UFO just accelerates away and it's gone. How does the UFO perceive that there's some kind of interaction, there's going to be some kind of engagement? Yet it does. So it's obvious this intelligence is far more advanced than we could ever comprehend. Another example would be the rock angler, the guys who fish off the cliff tops at Bempton, and he sees an unusual star. Mick Sigson, they called this guy. He'll not mind me using his name. And as he's looking at this star, because he realises he's not seen this before, he's just looked in the sky and there's what he perceives to be a star. Split second later, it's over the top of him. It's lit the ground up all around him. He says, like a welding torch, the grass looked like blades of silver. He says, and then as fast as it arrived, it had gone. Obviously, it wasn't a star, but there's the I termed it the intermind connection. There's some kind of connection there. And I just wonder, when I saw this thing over Mexborough, the sphere over the rooftops, whether some kind of connection was made. I guess it's impossible to say, you know, and I know some people are absolutely sold on the idea of their theory being the only one. Well, I'm quite open to learning everything. And what I think now might change next year if somebody can show me some better proof or some other alternative theory that's worth pursuing. I don't know is the answer, Whitley.
Free Dreamlanders, we're going to take a little break now on your behalf. Subscribers, we'll keep right on keeping on. This is Whitley Strieber. Listen to me now from June of 2010 talking to Alan Lammers about an incredible thing that happened to him on the island of Sulawesi in Indonesia. Here you are in South Sulawesi in the little town in the district of Sandu Batu. You were, what happened? You were told something rather strange.
Well, we were told before we went, like my friends that I worked with in, with the NGO, they told me that when you pack, because it kind of happened by accident, I went out to buy a raincoat. It rains quite a bit in this part of the world. And so I went out and I bought a yellow raincoat. And my friend said, I'm sorry, you can't take that to Walla Walla. And I said, well, why not? And he says, well, you can't wear that color. So anyways, excuse me. So I thought, okay, well, what colors can I wear? They said, well, you can only wear black or white. You cannot wear any bright colors, no bright green, especially no yellow. And, you know, that's all you should bring. And I said, well, what would happen? And they said, well, people disappear.
You will find the rest of that story, and it is brain-bending, in the June 5th edition of Dreamland, June 5, 2010 edition of Dreamland in the unknowncountry.com archive. This archive is one of the richest of its kind in the world, probably is the richest of its kind in the world, filled with extraordinary shows, of which this show is certainly one, this show with Alan Lammers. You will never have heard anything like it. It does what Dreamland is here to do. It opens your mind to the fact that we live inside a hidden reality that we prefer not to acknowledge, but not here. Here on unknowncountry.com, we do acknowledge it. We live in it and we love it. Subscribe today. You can't go wrong. Go to unknowncountry.com right now and get started. We're back with Paul Sinclair, his new book, Night People. It's a departure from his previous work. His previous books have all they're called the Truth Proof series, and they're basically about events that happened in Yorkshire, in the general area where he lives, which turns out to be, like many other places in this world, if you look under the stones, a very strange place, but it's perhaps a little stranger than most. And Paul, what drew you to being a researcher in the first place? Was it a conscious awareness of this in your life and then you weren't talking about it? Or did the awareness come back as you did research?
Good question, Whitley. It was always there. I never planned to write a book. But the actual interest, the actual passion for the subject of not just UFOs, but the unexplained, it never left me. I think in the early years, obviously, I didn't understand the extent of what had happened, you know, until I started to get older and mature a little bit. And then I started thinking a little bit more deeply about the events that had happened to me. But if ever there were a report of a UFOs in the new local newspapers, I'd be straight on it and sort of looking in the areas and making notes and spending time. It was just a natural progression, Whitley. And at the age of 48, I packed in my job as a joiner, as a carpenter. Not because I've got loads of money, guys, but I'd worked very hard and had enough to sort of pursue this full time. And it literally is a full time job. And we're not talking 6 or 7 hours a day. I'm up at 4 and 5 in the morning and I'll get that much information and I'm following leads up. And it's unrelenting, but I wouldn't be doing it if I didn't enjoy it, Whitley. And all I'm about is putting witness accounts up that I think are genuine in as good a light as possible to give those witnesses as much credibility as possible and try to rule everything out, to rule out the ridicule factor for the witness. Because as you know, there's nothing worse than seeing something that's life-changing, that's mind-altering, only to tell people and get looked at like you're crazy. And, you know, with my own story, I've had that all my life. But in the end, I've just decided, look, I'm being disingenuous to myself. If I don't say these things have happened, I don't shout it from the rooftops, but, you know, one, we published Night People, and I'm now pleased that I did. I don't know if I've gone off thread a little bit there, Whitley. I do apologize to the listeners if I have, but...
No, that's okay. That's what we're here for. We're here to talk. And
so,
go ahead.
So I just collect these sightings, and I've got hundreds and hundreds of people, police officers, scientists, all sorts of people coming to me sharing information, because they know that I can be trusted. If I'm asked not to give any delicate information away, I don't do that. If I'm asked not to write about something, I don't, but I still want the story. At the moment, we're working on a documentary called The Dark Forest Project. That's the working title. We do have a title for it, which we're just not going to come out with at the moment, but it
just as well. I wouldn't do that if I were you.
No, I never thought for one second, guys, that I would be researching cryptids. But during the research into the first Truth Proof book, and local newspapers putting out little articles for me asking for stories of the unexplained, paranormal stories, big alien big cat stories, as in alien to the UK, these stories kept coming up about what they termed the Flixton werewolf. And when I started really researching it deep, and I've probably looked into it more than anyone in the world, and if that sounds like a boast, it's simply because it's true. It's probably one of, if not the oldest, werewolf story in the world, where in sort of 937 AD, a refuge was built under the instructions of King Athelstan, not some fictitious king, a real king, to protect travellers from an infestation of savage beasts. That was the wording. And other beasts that then abound, lest they be devoured, I think the words were. And, you know, so anyway, I ended up looking into these cryptid sightings. And that is why in North Yorkshire, I'm in East Yorkshire, by the way, that it'll be about 30 miles from where I live. I've been spending overnight stays in the forests of North Yorkshire with actual witnesses, with gamekeepers. I mean, these guys are seasoned. They work the land. They live the land. They work those forests year in, year out. And we've got gamekeepers claiming to have seen things that defy explanation, truly terrifying things. And, people may be thinking to themselves, well, why are you putting yourself in that position? But if I've got people coming to me, giving me these accounts, once again, people, independent witnesses with no connection to each other. Some of the sightings of these things that we're referring to from the 1997, the 2000s. I've got some reports from the late Tony Dodd, who I'm sure you will have been familiar with, Whitley, the retired police sergeant who wrote the book Alien Investigator.
Yes.
And he obviously lived in the same area as me, and he was aware of the extent of the unexplained phenomena in that area. Well, I've got a few letters, been fortunate enough to obtain a few things that from Tony Dodd, and talking about unusual creatures in these forests in the 1990s. So that's what we're immersed in at the moment. That's where I'll be tomorrow night, all night. We won't be sleeping. It's just gathering information. We're not in there thinking that we're going to get film footage of this thing, but I'm lucky enough to be going in with some people, former witnesses, and we're going to record their story and try and get the feel of the atmosphere. If anything should occur, it would be quite amazing, and I'm probably terrifying, but amazing as well. But we're taking thermal cameras in there, infrared cameras, good quality camcorders, lighting. So we're not doing it lightheartedly or using a phone to film these things. We're taking it really serious and obviously wanting to do the witness justice to what they're telling us.
And so you'll continue basically on this journey, this life journey of yours that started, I guess, in 1966, really?
Yeah, from childhood to present day.
Right.
It's unrelenting, Whitley.
Like, you know, so many of us. My childhood, too. I mean, most of the close encounter witnesses listening to this are probably nodding their heads and saying, yeah, it started in my childhood, too. The the idea that aliens would come and they'd land in a flying saucer and they'd come into your house and look you over and then leave again, perhaps taking you with them for an unpleasant little adventure that lasted an hour or so, is not enough. This is somehow part of life. In other words, it's woven into our lives.
Without a doubt. And what a good analogy to use, woven into our lives. Yeah, you're the fabric of being human. These beings, these visitors, as you termed them in your incredible book, Communion, you know, not necessarily the same type of being, I don't know, but they're here. And regardless of what researchers want to argue about, as in it couldn't possibly be here because they can't travel these vast distances, it does not make one shred of difference to the thousands upon thousands of people who claim to have seen these things. The things that happened to me, Whitley, were not sleep paralysis. I've got scars on my back, I've scars on my arms where I've got flashbacks of seeing these things, but then woken up with scars, you know, and the medical notes with the doctors saying we're perplexed by the punch hole lesions that are appearing on the young man's skin. This is back in the 1990s, but 1994 to 98 was the most prolific time when they were interfering with me, should we say. And, you know, you'd wake up in the night and, you know, the uneasy silence, you know, something's wrong. And, you know, I don't know whether this happened to you or it happened to other people, but I were always going to be prepared when it happened, but I never was. I think I wrote in the book, they've already gone before you've realised they've arrived. Because when you're immersed in the moment, you can't escape from it. And it's that surreal, it's that overwhelming to my mind anyway, that I am literally a rabbit caught in the headlights. I can recall the night the holes appeared in my back and we were in the back bedroom of this property where I live now. And there's no cars at the back of us. There's another set of houses, but there's an extensive garden at the back. So, and I woke up and something were wrong. I just knew something was wrong, but I hadn't connected that it were them. I just knew something was wrong. It's weird. I don't know how your brain becomes so detached from the thing that you're focused on so much when it's not happening. But I saw lights sweep around the room and the curtains were shut, almost like a car turning round in the road and it had sweep past your window. And then we're upstairs, so there's no cars are there. And then I saw him again. And then I saw a glimpse of him in the light and the tall beings and small beings. I think the two tall ones. Then I didn't see them, but I'd got this incredible pain in my back. It was just absolutely excruciating. And they're there at the bed and they're telling me, it's not talking to me, Whitley, not talking. It's I don't even know how to explain it. But they're talking to me in my mind, telling me it's a bedspring of all things turning in my back. My wife's at side of me asleep. I don't see her. I'm not saying I looked and I saw her, but I'm wrestling with this idea that there's a bedspring turning in my back. But at the same time, there's another part of my brain knows it's not, because I've seen them. But I'm helpless. And you can probably feel frustration, because I feel frustrated just talking about it. And the pain was unbelievable, and something was in my back turning. It felt like a corkscrew turning. It were excruciating. It were just incredible, the pain. And I must have blacked out. And the next morning, temporarily, I'd forgotten about it. And I get up and I sit on the edge of the bed, and Mary, my wife, must have woke up and looked around, and I'm naked and I just sat there. And she says, "Paul, I don't believe it. You've got three holes in your back." Seriously, on my children's lives, that's what she said to me. And then I got a flashback. I saw the light. I saw them. And slowly,
like
throughout
the light in 1966.
Oh, God, good God. Slowly throughout that day, little bits come back. Now, I don't have a solid timeline of events on any of these things. I've not got a start. I've not got a middle or an end. I've just got flashbacks. I'd already been receiving holes in my arms and getting and seeing these beings, waking up and having the holes peppered in my arms. So I'd been visiting the doctors for quite a long time because they hadn't a clue what was happening. I didn't tell them. I just wanted some treatment for them. But I, with the holes in my back, these were worse. These were like bullet holes. They were deep. And I'm not joking.
Big? How deep were they?
Well, I'm not sure. I think we've put one of the doctor's reports in the book, and it says the wounds extend deep into the dermis. Now, you'll have to forgive me, people, because I don't have this in front of me. And they talked about them in a later letter, saying that they'd healed with giant foreign body cells. Now, that doesn't mean anything alien. I'm led to believe that implies a surgical procedure had taken place. Now, I'm sat in the hospital at Bridlington General Hospital when the morning these appeared, because these were worse. It weren't a trip to the doctors. These were worse. There were no pain with them. I sort of liken it to if you saw an hole in the ice and you saw the liquid, and it's all sort of, they were cauterized, but they were liquid inside them, but there were no blood on the sheets. There was nothing. My wife said that there was ash on my back, surprisingly. She said there was ash.
Ash,
that's what she said. She said there was ash. And just jumping from that, listeners, briefly, we had found ash on the pillow as well, unusual ash over the years. Not for a long time, but we have found it. I need to stress that none of us smoke. My wife's never smoked a cigarette in her life, and I haven't. And the ash was very thin and fine, but like the ash you would get off a cigarette, but only as thick as a thin straw, if that makes sense.
If you ever get it again, do try to collect it.
Well, we did. We have got a sample of it in a little plastic container somewhere, and we know we have. And I don't mean, unusually they can't say they can lay their hands on it. We will do, but we've looked for it before. It is somewhere in this property, just like a piece of. I'm deviating now. There's another thing that happened, but we'll.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Unusually, I was watching on the TV there's something about the Skinwalker Ranch.
Skinwalker Ranch, yes.
And I was playing it through the laptop, through the TV. And when I went to end what we were watching, I tell a lie, Whitley. It was George Knapp talking about it, one of his lectures. But when I went to sort of unplug everything, there was piles of. Tiny piles of white powder on the laptop and some like crystallized chunks. Now, I definitely have them and I know where they are. And they were on the laptop. Strange. I don't have an explanation for it. The ceilings, I need to stress, in this house are all new and plastered. I've converted this house into three flats. Meaning, listeners, it's not something that's fell from the ceiling. So I've lost my thread a little bit here because we're at Bridlington Hospital.
Right.
And the doctor's looking at me and he's looking at the wounds. He suggested that they were laser wounds or they looked a little bit like laser wounds because they were cauterized. Then he started questioning me and saying, Mr. Sinclair, you can tell us. We think you couldn't have done these yourself because of the position, but we need to know who's done this. You can tell us in confidence. And they thought I were being abused. Now, I don't know what were worse. Well, I do. I didn't tell them what
your wife was abusing you with a laser powerful enough to make holes in your back. That's no small laser. You can't do that like with a laser pointer that you could get at the store.
Well, the problem I had though is I knew what it was, but I would have made it worse for myself if I'd have told them.
Oh, absolutely. You would have been liable to have ended up in the mental ward.
Without a doubt, and it was sort of double bad in a way because they knew I were lying. I were lying, but I were lying for my own reasons. Well, everybody lies for their own reasons, I suppose. But I think the listeners get what I'm saying. And not a nice situation. And that happened throughout 1994. It happened in childhood just once. I'd got one in my shoulder, which I remembered how it came about. But 1994 to 1998 was the time I received.
How old were you then? How old were you when you went to the hospital with the wounds?
Oh, 1994. I'm 57 now, listeners. I'd have been in my 30s, wouldn't I? But about 30 years old. I've not worked that one out, but off the top of my head.
But in your 30s, and what exactly do you remember? You remember the pain?
Oh, it was excruciating. Yeah, whatever. It went deep into my back. I remembered the lights. I remember waking up and knowing I felt strange. I don't think I thought the here. I just knew I felt strange. It's that feeling you just can't gather your senses when it hits you. And then
I know it well, and so do any number of the people listening to this show right now. Go ahead.
Yeah, and so the lights swept round the room again. It was almost like they were sweeping round the room, and I saw them. And then they disappeared. I didn't see them again. And then I think I probably saw them another time. And then
what exactly did you see? Describe what you saw.
Beings with large heads, very emaciated torsos. I think there were two tall ones. Very, very emaciated. Just looking down at me. Frightening. Large eyes. I suppose your typical what people would think are aliens.
And do you know where you were?
I was in my bedroom. I don't think I was anywhere else. But Whitley, you're good point here. You've just brought that up again. I'm wondering if I was, because I was laid on my back, and the procedure that happened was on my back. How is that possible when you're laid on a mattress?
Well, you know, when you're I'm basically interviewing you the way I would an abductee, and one of the things you do is you circle back, because you've detected that I've been doing that, and that's fine, but sometimes it elicits more information without leading the person. So you've now realized that you couldn't have been on your back. You couldn't have been lying on your back.
I couldn't have been lying on my back, Whitley. No, I mean, I think I've written that, but you wouldn't have got that out of me without you saying that question today. Not because I didn't want to tell you. You've managed to pull that bit out, so I'm glad you did. Because I sort of accept the fact that laid in bed, whatever they did to my back or on my back couldn't have took place if I was in bed. Yet everything about the scenario was suggesting I was in bed, and it was a bed spring turning in my back. And there's no bed springs popping out of our bed, listeners. You know, it's the craziest scenario. But and the way that you're spoken to, the actual speaking into your mind, that how can we comprehend it? How can we? You know.
Well, because people say, oh, it's telepathy, but they have never had it happen. It's much more intimate than some voice like in your head. It's really odd.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, without a doubt. Yeah, you're absolutely hit the nail on the head there. It's much more intimate than thinking things and hearing a conversation between two friends as you're doing a bit of recall, sat relaxing in the room, thinking about a conversation I've had with somebody. This is an actual voice that's speaking in your head.
Yes.
And it's not schizophrenia, listeners. This is totally outside of anything I'm familiar with, and it only occurs when these beings were present. It's terrifying.
Well, you know, there's something going on today in the sense that this silence in this place is I feel a presence myself when I'm talking to you. It's like I'm not alone here, and that there's somebody else participating in the conversation through my mind. Sometimes Anne will show up during these meetings, during the interviews, very often, in fact. But this is not her. This is someone to do with you.
Well, that is interesting, because I did think of your wife before the show, because I remember one of the shows we did, she'd been reading some of my work, and she were on my mind actually just before the show. But so I'm pleased you've mentioned that. But
she was here yesterday, very, very powerfully, and last night too. She often is, and she meditates with me when I meditate at night, and when it's time to go to bed, she will indicate that by sending a gentle sort of electrical shock through my legs that I can feel very clearly, and it's like down by my ankles, and it's like saying, okay, it's time to get up and go to bed now. And she's wonderful about it. She's a real, but she's not, it's not her now. It's someone to do with you. And they right. seem to be me to be very aware of you and in a searching, intense way. You know what I think you should do, Paul?
Yeah.
I think you should do past life regression with somebody who's really good at that, because I think this has something to do with your past.
Okay.
Before you were born into this life.
Well, there's another suggestion from Whitley Strieber that I should probably follow up.
Yeah, I think you might find it interesting if you manage to do it just very objectively without any it's going to be hard, very yeah. hard, because your expectations will intervene. And speaking of expectations, Free Dreamlanders, I firmly expect, and I'm quite serious now, that you will do what these commercials ask you to do, especially the ones that say to subscribe to Unknown Country, and they will tell you some of the wonderful, rich shows that you could listen to in our vast archive, and including Paul's. Paul's got some marvelous shows in our archive. We'll be right back.
Some of the most thrilling, mind-opening interviews ever recorded are in the Dreamland Archive. Open your mind to Sir Lawrence Gardner's brilliant vision of the past. Listen to Russell Targ's phenomenal insights about ESP. Be inspired by Dr. Eben Alexander's stunning near-death experience. Listen to an actual recording from a plane as it was attacked by a gigantic flying disc. Be transported to a new level of inner grace with Whitley Strieber's meditations. Enjoy The Communion, Transformation, Majestic, Secret School, and Superstorm audiobooks, and so much more. The UnknownCountry.com subscriber section. As little as 10 cents a day. Priceless.
Whitley and Ann Strieber's book, Miraculous Journey, is well on its way to becoming a classic. One reader after another has found hope and inspiration in the pages of this deeply moving book. From reader Martin Taylor, a book to savor, like much of the Strieber's work, this is a very moving read, and I find myself smiling as much as holding back tears. From Melissa Latimer, this is a beautiful, hopeful story of the power of love in the face of life-changing health problems. From Raven Dana, this book is moving, instructive, and most of all, a beautiful testament to the power of love. And from Catherine Cook, the authors guide us through their dark night of the soul with beautiful prose and truly inspiring insights that leave the reader feeling hope and joy. Reader after reader has taken Miraculous Journey into their heart, and you will too. Available wherever electronic books are sold for just $4.99.
Now also available from Amazon and Barnes & Noble in hardcover and softcover.
We're talking to Paul Sinclair, his new book, Night People. He's the author of the Truth Proof series, and which is a fascinating series of books that you can get from the UnknownCountry.com bookstore. Get through the bookstore. Just go to the store tab on UnknownCountry.com's homepage. Click on it, and you'll see Whitley's books and podcast authors. Click on podcast authors, and you will soon find Paul's books. Or you can go to this week's Dreamland and click on the store tab there, and it'll take you right to all of Paul's books. And they're fascinating, very well done books. He writes well and very vividly. In fact, let me read you one of the blurbs. England's green and pleasant land can be a very strange place, as Paul Sinclair's new book demonstrates. That was said by me, Whitley Strieber, and it's on the back cover. Paul shines a light not just on anomalous phenomena, but on the human aspects of all this. That's from Nick Pope. Robbie Williams. I love how Paul writes, which, to be honest with you, is at times terrifying. And one of the legendary figures in our world, Philip Mantle, says Paul Sinclair is just honest and direct, irrespective of the subject. Howard Hughes, who is a well-known broadcaster in England, broadcasting about the paranormal for many years, this book took courage and perseverance to compile. And that's where I want to go next, Paul. However did you do this? Because I know how hard it is to bring forward memories, and you've done a very good job here. Was there a process involved of remembering and putting it together, or did it just seem to come out of you?
Well, I always had the sphere on the rooftops at Old Denneby. I always remembered that. I did hope, Whitley, writing the book, that new memories or more of the events would come forward, and it only happened twice, and it were quite uneventful. That one of them, I'll get to what you asked in a minute. Whilst writing about Church Street and an event on Church Street, it came back to me. There was kicking lots and lots of leaves up again the church. So from that, I got autumn. I knew it was autumn, which is no great revelation, but a process. I'm probably like yourself, is that this subject never actually leaves your mind. I don't know whether we're sad or whether it's the fact that we've just been touched by it so strongly and we have such a passion that we want to get as much of it out of our systems and to the public and I wouldn't say the believers, because I want to convert people. I want people to understand that there's an absolute concrete reality to what we're talking about. So every time something came into my mind, I'd make a note of it. I'd write it down or add it into a Word document, and then try and get some timeline of events, such as the first time I realized what was happening. There's a chapter in the book called We Will Shock You. And
you know, actually, I am looking right now at that chapter, because that's my next question.
We're in sync
here, Paul. Go ahead.
Which chapter was it, Whitley?
Chapter 5, it's called We Will Shock You, The Age of Understanding.
I know I'd done it, but I couldn't remember which chapter. But I was in a property next door to ours with a friend called Philip White. Young boys, I'm not sure how old I was, 13, 14 at the time. And he was a massive Queen fan, the band Queen. And Bohemian Rhapsody was playing, and it was number one. And when I saw the video, as it was, and you saw the faces of the band in that casting in that shadow, and suddenly these beings that I'd sort of, because they'd been interacting with me from a young age on a personal level and not in front of other people, it always happened in the night.
Yes.
You know, I didn't share it with anybody, but suddenly these beings just punched into the front of my mind. And I started thinking about them more. So
Bohemian Rhapsody is a trigger, like the communion face, for a lot of Close Encounter witnesses.
Yeah, well, so there you go, 1975. So we could put a date to that one. So then I can remember my age. From there, I can put an age of 14, you know, so... And that's how it slowly built up, Whitley. I mean, Jessica, one of my daughters, she said to me a few months ago, she's dad, because she's read Night People. She said, you have an amazing memory. She really did say this. She said, I'm reading things that I'd forgotten about. And there you are, you're telling me about, such as the morning, in the early hours of the morning, Jessica came into our bedroom, woke me up, because this house we lived in is now three flats, but it had a huge mahogany staircase that wound all the way around to the top over three floors. Really spectacular it was. That's gone now, but she woke me up, and we followed a sphere of light downstairs. And I have no recall of it, but Jessica had. And my recall is Jessica telling me about it. Now, listeners, what I mean, at the time, I didn't remember it happening. But Jessica says, I woke up in the night and we got up and we followed a sphere of white light downstairs. And she doesn't know what happened after that. But when Jessica read it, she said, "I'd forgot all about it, Dad." She said, "I can't believe it." You know, and Jessica had relayed the story, which I'd then written about in Night People. So it just built over I would say a lot more than a few years, because these stories have never left my mind. I don't know about Hugh Whitley or other listeners who've been touched by this weirdness, this paranormal soup that we're immersed in. When I go to bed on a night, obviously you do think of other things, but there's rarely a night goes past without these events slipping into my mind. Mostly, I'm looking for a little bit more of the jigsaw puzzle, which I can't find, listeners. I've not got a start, middle, and an end. I've got cameos, the sort of strongest parts of these events, probably the most traumatic parts, because there's not many nice things to talk about as far as Paul Sinclair is concerned when it comes to the Night People, the visitors. It's not been a good experience for me.
No, it's not a good experience. I had many years of struggle with this, but of course now it's so intimate, so much a part of my life that it is a good experience now. Yeah. It's interesting. I have embarked on a kind of personal moral crusade to really live what I can of a good life by love, compassion, and humility. And as I have very consciously done that, the experience has changed. In other words, I don't get that violent aspect of it now anymore. When I'm working on this book, I'm working on a book about Jesus, for example, and the intimacy and it's an amazing symbiosis almost between me and Anne and a lot of other entities, some of them living and some of them what we call dead.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I think that your life and your book is an effort, Night People is an effort like Communion was, to try to find a way for yourself that gives you some kind of something worth having from this, because it's right now, I mean, you're being beaten up, man, and or ignored when you want to be, when you want to have some kind of interaction and understanding. And then things show up and they make holes in your body, and wow.
This is true. And you put it over very well again. And obviously the actual intrusions, should we say, have died back as I've got older, but the passion to understand the phenomena has got stronger.
And right.
And I don't think that's ever going to wane. I've like you said, I'm looking for answers for myself, but I'm also looking for answers for other people. I know that you know, for every one person that speaks about this subject with a passion and with truth, there's thousands out there that are sat in silence with stories probably 10 times better than mine. And it's for those people as well that I want to speak about this subject and try and just make it as honest and as truthful as we can. All the naysayers, I mean, people can say that, I don't know, this is sleep paralysis, this is the fantastic imagination.
Listen, it's not sleep paralysis if it sends you to the hospital with holes in your back, period.
Without a doubt. And there's the reality of this subject. It's one of the biggest things in the world. And the sooner people wake up to the reality of that, the better. Whether it happens in my lifetime, it's very debatable, but I'm so pleased that now I have gone ahead with Night People. Let's put it that way, Whitley.
Well, it's the next step for you. You're going to get a lot of enrichment out of this, probably from many different directions that you didn't expect. But I keep going back to that Templar connection, because what happened then was the destruction of a node of truth on planet Earth, that when those poor men were rounded up and all burned to death. That was evil in action. And in some sense, it seems to still be after you. After all these years.
There's something not with good intention being pursuing me during the night from childhood till at least the late 1990s. And there's been odd minor incidents after that. But, you know, it's fueled a passion in me to sort of look for the truth. But, you know, I don't know what time we've got, Whitley, but just a little story.
We're going to end the first hour in a few minutes, so go ahead and let's get before we go into the story, since we're just at the top of the hour, we'll go ahead and end the first hour. So Free Dreamlanders, I love you, and we'll see you next week. I'm always so happy that so many of you listen to this show, and as always, I do hope you decide to go to Unknown Country and start a subscription. It's well worth it. Thank you very much for being with us. Subscribers will keep right on.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.